It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Welcome to Hoop du Jour with moi, Peter Vesey, presented by the National Basketball Retired Players Association. Frank,
sir,
again, week three.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? What do you think we should do?
What do I think we should do?
Yeah.
Well, let's see. It's you, it's me, and it's Jerry West in the green room. You figure out what we should do.
Yeah, I think we talk to each other enough during the days that we don't have to talk to each other too much. Let's just go right to Jerry.
I believe that's probably the correct course of action.
All right. Jerry, welcome.
Great to see you again.
Man, great. It's an honor, as usual. We go back a long way. We're not going to talk about that. I did that with Oscar. But as long as I mentioned Oscar's name, you know, last week we had him on, and he was saying that, well, you had told me over the years how much you couldn't believe that he had such a smooth transition from college to pros, and it took you, you said, a half a season. Tell me a little bit about that, why it took you so long, and what do you think of Oscar Robertson's game?
Well, first of all, I absolutely loved him, both as a competitor and as a teammate, during our Olympic Games together. And the thing that I thought was really unique about him, Pete, as I mentioned to you many times before, is how advanced he really was. And I attribute it to probably the fact that he played against some really good competition where he grew up in Indianapolis. And being exposed to those kind of players, players who had a different kind of skill level than some kid from West Virginia, who worked in a coal mine, and you go out and play, compete against, it wasn't the same level. It was more, highly achieved players who had competed in college, and I didn't see that kind of competition at all. He had more players to learn from, but again, you have to look at him for what he was. He had great skill. He had terrific size for a backcourt player at that point in time. He's like 6'5", and I was 6'4½". And I think his ability to play the game on both ends of the court, and particularly his leadership skills, getting the ball to people in the right time, being a play ahead all the time on the offensive end, he just had a mind that was much further progress than myself. It wasn't close. And it really showed up to me during the Olympic Games when we had an opportunity to play together, just to see how he would get into things that Pete Newell, who was our coach, it was pretty fascinating, really, to watch him. And, you know, being someone who I've always felt I've been kind of a sponge in the sense I want to soak up as much information as I can, regardless of what it might be in life. But at that time, at that point in time, I was a player trying to look to get better. And how do you get better? You watch people that you know that play the game in a unique way. And that's what helped me so much, playing against him. And I knew inside of myself that there was something there that had not been touched before. And instead of just going out playing the game, reacting to the speed of the game, there's so much more to that. And the players achieve at the highest level, they think the game differently than players who are even all-star players. There's a unique group of players that have that skill. You always know what somebody's going to do. But the point is, in this game, sometimes it might not be good enough if you know what somebody's going to do, because they might catch you just a little bit off balance to be able to say defensively, if you're playing someone, they can beat you regardless of what you do defensively.
I gotta stop you though, Jerry. How did you do against him once things evened out? You did guard each other, right? Many times, right? How did you do?
Well, you know, with me, Pete, I've always felt that as an offensive player, you have to look at what they do best. And I never felt like he was just going to blow by me, okay? But he could go get to where he wanted, big, strong body, knew how to use his body, which is a gift in itself and also a strength of players. And as you get older and more experienced, you learn how to do that. But with me, I always try to play one guy, keep him going one way, not to be able to beat you both ways. I just think that players are too good when you allow them to beat you both ways. And today it's gotten even worse because the ability of players to handle the ball, but more importantly, you know, the Euro step, the walking steps that are walking a dog, to be honest with you.
There's a bigger exchange rate.
You know what? If I can interrupt for a second, I watched a game one day last week. There were so many steps taken, I was waiting for a guy to put in for mileage. It really was just.
Well, if you look how all sports, think how all sports have changed. Okay, look at baseball. One time, a baseball pitcher would like the badge of honor was to pitch 9 innings, correct, throw 120 pitches. Now they throw about 80 pitches or 85, and that's it. So people are used to strikeouts and home runs today. And that's the way the game, specialists. It's a game of specialists. Yeah. And the football, no one can touch the quarterback anymore. You can't touch a wide receiver.
Yeah. Well, you can't touch the ball handlers either.
Well, you can't. And no. So the rules, what do people go to boxing matches for? They don't go for a decision. They won't see somebody get knocked out. Why do they go to a baseball game? Again, strikeouts and home runs. I love to see guys hit home runs. Even golf today, the guy that everyone's talking about, who just they want to see how far Bryson DeChambeau can hit the ball. So every game has changed, and within that, obviously boundaries have to be changed. And people pay for excitement, and that's why we see these things allowed. I don't know the difference between a Euro step and a jump stop is walking. I don't get that. Why is jump stop a walking? If you just go jump and you don't move your feet, you're playing it, okay? But the other one is, yeah. I mean, I see guys carrying the ball down the floor like this, and you say to yourself, you know, how far they have come. And it's just an evolution, I think, in all sports. There's so much information. Everyone has all this information, knowledge. I think on our coaching staffs, we might – between coaches and people or workout coaches, we probably have 14 people. And to think that one time you had maybe one coach and then one assistant coach, and today you just have all this knowledge there that these kids are coming in at such an early age, Pete, that right, they need help, regardless of how skilled they are. They need help to see the game in a different way, and that's why you see them have so much help.
You know, Jerry, there's also the Hall of Fame now has about 14 presenters for each recipient.
Well, it's hard to watch. It really is. it's like, what's the longest movie ever made? You go there, and you say to yourself, when is this going to get over with? And you know, obviously I'm very zealous and about the Hall of Fame. I think that in some respects that I would like to see different kind of people get in the Hall of Fame where the criterion is very much like baseball. Some right. years, no one gets in baseball's Hall of Fame.
Right. Want me to send you my speech when I went in, Jerry, in case you missed it? You want to?
Yeah.
Jerry, let me stop.
I mean, go ahead.
Jerry, you know, you talked about, you know, you learn from other people when you're growing up. You know, you see the better player, whatever. You didn't have television in those days to watch those kind of games. Yeah. But I've always wondered how you developed the low dribble, the low last dribble, being a hard dribble, and then elevating. How did you learn that?
I don't know, Pete. One summer I was at West Virginia University, and I was a freshman in my – after my freshman season, they got me a job. I was a water boy. They were building a dam in Morgantown, West Virginia. And I was a water boy, and I couldn't even drive, but that was an adventure in itself. But I would go down in my spare time to the gym, and I just – there's something about, you know, dribbling a ball, and you don't have to expose the ball in front of a defender. It's up and up here quickly till you can shoot the ball. And I actually had scratched my face to this day. I still have a scratch by trying to keep it so close to my body so you didn't expose the ball so much. And I felt it also, even transitioning to the NBA, it really helped a lot because there's a lot of hand checking going on with both hands. You know, so you almost feel like you had a steering wheel on you. But what it helped me, with much better balance, on shooting the ball. And if you're drifting all over the place, unless you're an extraordinary shooter, you're not going to be able to, convert them, particularly when you got people bumping you. And that really helped me a lot.
I mean, it was unstoppable shot. But Jerry, you mentioned your nose, and there was a game in Kentucky where they broke your nose at least once, maybe twice. And then I looked it up. That was against Adolph Rupp's team. And do you know how many times your nose was broken in your career?
I do, Pete. Unfortunately, nine times. Once in college. And at University of Kentucky, and that the first time was a horrible, horrible break. Pete, I basically didn't have a nose. I really didn't. It would just smash flat. And I was getting ready to jump and go after a rebound, and this guy mistimed his jump, and he came down, and his elbow hit me right on top of my nose, and I played the rest of the game. We won the game, and there's always some stories behind these things, Pete. And one of the really kind of amazing stories with this was that, as I say, I've bled so much during the course of the game, it was crazy. About 10 years ago, I get a package. And again, my God, that was in 1958, I believe, or 59. And I get a package in the mail, and it was from a kid who was a ball boy, that he had kept this towel, it says Kentucky on it, and has all this blood. He said, I thought you might want to. It was almost cryptic to get.
He could have gotten a lot of money for that.
Oh, well, today everyone sells anything. I'm not
thinking stuff like that. So nine times, Jerry. I mean, what is it about your nose that people were accidentally on purpose hitting with elbows?
Well, Pete, you know, I tell you what was really weird. I had the same person who played for the New York Knicks do a run, actually trying to steal balls is what it was from, two times in 6 weeks, my nose was broken by Willis Reed.
It wasn't deliberate.
It wasn't deliberate. You know what's deliberate and what's not.
Right.
And almost the same way. And as I say, I was an aggressive defender, particularly when there was loose balls and people dribbling. And I had long arms and quick hands, and I can get a lot of steals and anticipate steals. And sometimes when you're going like that, you know, you're reaching and – your nose exposed, and people play in this league forever and never get a broken nose.
Never, exactly.
And it was not fun, Pete, in the sense that scar tissue bleeds a lot more. But I never missed a game from a broken nose.
I never reached for a ball, loose ball. Loose woman, yes, but not a loose ball.
Right. Well,
sorry, Jerry.
It was really, really funny in the sense that you you try like crazy to keep out of harm's way, so to speak. It doesn't work that way. And again, particularly if you just don't stand around and you're aggressive, but it was not fun. I mean, I had times when playing a game. I'll never forget. We played a game in San Diego. And I had white shoes on, and Pete, I mean, they were red after the game. I brought my nose broken in the first half, and I'll never forget that. And coming over in timeouts, and I know it's horrible to talk about, but blood was just gushing out of your mouth, and you know, they pack your nose, but you still bleed so much. And it didn't bother me, but the guys, my teammates, they just got completely away from me. And I was, that would never happen today because they wouldn't let you play because of all the protocols in place today with blood. And, but I just, there's something about it. It used to make me mad.
Jerry, let's move on to a worse memory.
I love those, Pete.
A worse memory. The Celtics. Now, I remember, you know, when I did an article with your son back when you were getting the statue in L.A. outside Staples. He said to me that you would not allow the kids to wear anything green in the house, and that you hated the Lakers, hated the Celtics forever. Do you still hate the Celtics?
Oh gosh, no. That was, I think, probably people I used to kid.
Be honest, Jerry. Come on.
No, I'm going to be honest with Pete. I don't try to hide anything that's not true. But no, it was more of a, you know, making fun of it. But I don't think anyone's ever seen me wear green. I'll say that. but the green has changed so much in Boston. It changes all the time now. And as the NBA, I think they're trying to change the colors of green and blue and everything. So everyone looks like a rainbow when they play today. But no, as I say, I had great respect for the Celtics, and particularly
they ruined your life for a long, long time. I mean, you went to the finals, what, six times?
Six times in the 60s. Yeah. Three of them went to game seven.
Yeah. And it was, you know, I think, as anyone, regardless of what you do, when you wrote, you took pride in what you were writing was hopefully the truth. And when you're a player, excuse me, when you're a player, the thing that matters most at the end of the day, it's not about what you do. It's about winning. Who do you play for? You play for the fans. You play for your teammates, and you play for the uniform on your back. That's who you play for. But I really, honestly, I played for the fans, because when we first started in Los Angeles, we had to build a fan base, and they were vociferous. And, you know, every year when we came to Celtics, it was almost like the same story. You know, Lakers get to game seven, lose game seven. It was like torture. And for me, there's twice in the height of my career, I wanted to quit. I really did. It was that painful. I remember one night after a particularly horrible loss, I think 1969, when, regardless of what anyone says, we had the best team. We did not win. We had the best team. And it was like, I got in my car. I just took off driving. I took off. I got home about probably 5 o'clock in the morning after the game. It was just so painful to, no matter how you played, no matter how you played, no matter how the late Elgin Baylor played, it wasn't enough. And that was time truly, I didn't know if I could take this anymore. It was your worst nightmare to go in the arena, and I was so embarrassed. They had all these balloons hung in the end zone, and everyone said that's what motivated the Celtics. Well, I don't believe that for a second. The best team did not win, period. Right. It did not win.
Do you mind if we go over that game a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
This is a very, very controversial game. that was the game where Butch Van Vredenkoff did not reinsert Will Chamberlain. I believe, Frank, get me with the numbers here. He went out with about
five and change to go. I think he hurt an ankle getting a rebound. And with about Mel Counts came in. Then
you were down seven when he left.
Yeah. And then with about two and change to go, we said, I'm good to go. And what was the quote of Butch? We're doing okay without you, or something along those lines?
Right.
I had no clue. I did not hear any of this. And, you know, one of the things I said, when he went out, I didn't know if it was major or anything at all. And I'm never one to question if somebody's hurt, they're hurt. Okay. And it got very controversial. I think it was well known that Pete and Butch and Wilt did not really care for each other. And it was, you don't try to think about that in the heart of the game. You're just trying to get back in the ball game. And I did not hear that conversation at all. I was shocked when I heard it, but, and that was the last game Butch Van Breda-Kolff ever coached at Lakers.
Right, right. The owner, Jack Ken Cook, fired him soon after.
Yeah,
and you guys had such a chance to win that game. I think you had three chances at the end to take the lead, and there was either a turnover or a missed shot. And Mel Counts missed a shot at the end, too. Not in the last seconds, but he missed a shot down the stretch. I think Russell blocked it. So I'm saying, like, Wilt and Russell both had five fouls when Wilt went out. I mean, the game was there to be had, and Wilt sat.
Pretty well, sad. I will say, it's one of those stories that I wish I could talk about because I don't know. I mean, they're sitting over there on the bench. I didn't hear any of the dialogue at all. And after the game, you know, we didn't have the same volume of writers. We had quite a few then. But the media had just really started to get into professional basketball. And I'm talking about from, you know, all over the country. And even people out of the country would start to have an interest in it. And when this was over with, I had a number of writers come to me and, you know, say, what do you think about this? Well, how in the world can, first question, after you just lose, a gripping, ugly ending to a season, how can you want to even comment on that right. when you haven't even heard it? And I've had a lot of people say to me, oh, you knew what was going on. You knew what was going on. I knew they didn't like each other, care for each other. I knew that.
Right.
But at the end of the day, it was like, you know, don't bother me. Don't bother anyone. We lost, and it was just awful. It was awful. And, you know, I could see the gleam in the Celtics' eyes, and Bill was the coach of the team at that point in time. So a player coach who was an incredible player and a great, great person, they won again. It just was not fun.
Let's jump to a better time for you. In your 14-year career, you went to the finals 9 times. And then in 1972, you won your championship. Could you tell us something about that 33-game winning streak, starting with Elgin Baylor retiring X amount of games into the season, early in the season? My first question is, did Bill Sharman tell him that if he didn't retire, that he was going to replace him in the starting lineup with Jim McMillan? Or did just Elgin know that he couldn't compete at that level anymore?
You know, honestly, I don't know anything about what happened, okay? I go to practice one day, and we were, I think our record was 5-3 or 5-4.
Yeah.
And we had just been playing not very well. And Bill, during the training camp, Bill had said to me, he said, I want you to lead the league in assists. And I said, well, I said, you know, whatever. I said, that's when we win. And he says, well, we want to run more. And everyone looked at us and said, we're an older team that you couldn't run. Well, that's not really true. You have to run smart and you have to run effectively.
Right.
And it's not just running up and down the court and firing shots up around. It has to be organized. And so I go to practice that day and no Elgin. And somebody said, Elgin's retiring. And that's the first thing I knew about. And the first thing I said, well, I want to find out what's going on here. I tried to get in touch with Elgin, and I wasn't able to. But I did get in touch with him the next day. And he said that he had retired. The only thing I'd heard that they had called the owner, late owner was Jack Cook. They called him in the office and they'd asked him to retire. And because he was struggling, Pete, with, you know, he had two horrible injuries, leg injuries and the way he played, he needed to be at full strength the way he played, because he was a magnificent player, a great teammate, and a better person. But it was probably the shock of my life to go in the locker room and not see him after being there with him for 12 years, to not see him in the locker room. It was like I lost my best friend. I lost someone I cared about personally. But you know, you're obligated to play the game. There's nothing you can do about it. You can't sit down and dwell. Why don't you go play?
So you started that winning streak. You started against Baltimore, I believe. So 33 in a row. And I'm wondering all these years again, how, you know, Charman never gets enough credit in my mind for anything that he's ever done. I love the guy. I remember you and I sitting down with him in LA back in the day. We had a great couple of days with him. But how did he motivate you guys to stay mentally into it? Practices, tell me something he did differently. Well, one thing I heard is that he would put Wilt on the second team.
In practice, he would mix up things in practices. He really would. And so I think the thing I thought was very interesting is that Wilt's team never won a game in practice. Okay.
Oh boy.
It wasn't because he probably didn't even care. Okay. Practice then for him, everyone talks about minutes played. Pete, he's the only guy that ever played more minutes in a season than was ever scheduled. He played every minute of every game, and that included overtime.
Right.
So you didn't even need a backup center, but he never got hurt.
Right.
But, no, he did – Bill did stuff like that. He would – we had a plus-minus system. It was the craziest thing I've ever seen. At that point in time, I was making a lot more than when I was a rookie, and only because of being an all pro player, all defensive player, and stuff like that. That's how you get paid, okay, for your performance. And Wilt, of course, had all these accolades. And Bill asked him to be a rebounder and a defender, so he didn't want either one of shooting the ball. He was smart, because he's not doing that.
Right?
Let
Goodridge shoot and Jim McMillan.
Yeah, right. And we put Jimmy McMillan in the lineup, and Jimmy was another fantastic person. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like all of a sudden we moved the ball better. We became better defensively. We ran more. But we had the best rebounding in the team by a lot. And we could win any kind of a game, Pete. And that game, at that time, some of these games were really physical. I mean, very physical. You didn't want to go shoot a layup, I'll tell you that. And then we could win a wide open game. I think we averaged our point spread differential, I believe, was almost 14 a game. And Pete, there's a lot of games we didn't even play the last quarter. So it could have been gigantic during that period of time. We had games where I remember one game when we got hung up in Chicago and Wilt got the police took him off the plane because we'd been on this one airplane going to Philadelphia. We played that night in Chicago, go to the airport. We got out there at our plane was supposed to leave at 7:30. Now, remember, it's an hour's time difference in Philadelphia. And we get out there and we're sitting on the plane and they mechanical. It'll be 45 minutes or something like that. And then this just kept going on and on and on. All of a sudden, it's about 1:30, 2 o'clock, and we could have gone on three other planes and got there a reasonable time. We stayed, and so Wilt said something to someone come on the plane. He said, "If I had a gun, I'd shoot someone." They took him off the airplane. Oh my God!
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. And all of us were kind of laughing, but we're so tired. We finally get to Philadelphia. Remember, an hour's time difference. We finally get to Philadelphia at 5 something. The game is 7 or 7:30. We didn't even go to the hotel. No one had anything to eat except possible, because they wouldn't let you off the airplane. They just kept you on the airplane the whole time. And we get out there. We went right to the arena. And everyone was laughing because Wilt wasn't there. He's not going to be here tonight, right? Well, about 5 minutes to 7, he walks in. He starts bitching about, you guys just left me in Chicago. And everyone said, well, we didn't leave you in Chicago. You know, the police kept you there.
Right.
So he...
did they give him back his gun?
He dressed in a typical fashion, which was amazing to watch how he dressed. It was amazing. But he was so mad. I can't tell you how mad he was. He just kept saying how mad he was all as we left it. We left it there. The first quarter, we were in this. I think we won about 19 straight games. We're behind the first quarter by about 18 points. Philadelphia had a pretty good team. But we had this system, $5 for every rebound, $5 for every block shot, $5 for every steal, and $5 for every assist. And in this game, we end up winning this game by about 30 and hardly played any the last quarter. It was like an avalanche going down a mountain.
Who paid for that? Charmin paid that?
Yeah, he at the time, the team would pay it. You can't do that because of an inducement.
Right.
But the most important thing wasn't your paycheck. How much money did you make from all these steals, rebounds, assists, and stuff like that? But there were also turnovers were a $5 fine. But in that one game, he had 16 block shots and 35 rebounds. And I had my biggest payday. I had like 18 assists and about 9 steals in that game. But a guy would go by the bench, if you deflected a ball and somebody else picked it up, they'd go, guys would run down the court like this, half, right? So $2.50. But it served its purpose, and I led the league in assists. Chamberlain led the league in rebounding, and we won the championship. It was like a dream come true.
Yeah, Charmin knew what he was doing, wasn't he? How to motivate and
you know, he was simple, Pete. He wasn't one of these really complex coaches. The thing he wanted people to compete. And some people compete at a higher level, but he just had a way with people. And I used to tell him all the time, he asked me before the season started. He says, you know, do you want to? I have a question. I want Wilt to be the captain. I said, I've never been the captain since I've been on the Laker team anyway. And I played, of course, with Elgin. He was the captain of the team. And he was almost like this, saying that that would offend me. I said, why would that offend me? I don't care if I'm captain. That made no difference. Right. But I guess it's like being an honor guard.
right.
I think if I can interrupt, I think the burning question, Jerry, is with all the $5 here and $5 there, are you sure you were getting an honest count?
Oh, my God. After the game, Wilt would go over the guy. Wilt kept track of everything. How many rebounds and blocks up? He made him go back. He made him go back and look at films. And you didn't give me enough rebounds.
Jerry, I heard that when he led the league in assists, I think Frank McGuire was the coach then, but he led the league in assists, and that he would stand, you know, with his back to the basket, and they give him the ball, and then they cut off of him. And as they cut off of him, he would say their shooting percentages. So if you had a lousy shooting percentage, you pull the ball back.
Yeah, he was a real character. He was a real character. And, you know, later, a lot of people, you know, look around and they try to find reasons to, I guess, for some people to really get on him for nothing. He was just complex, okay? You know, I would be on elevators with him, and how's the weather up there? And I've heard of stories, not him, but another player spit on someone's head, and it's raining, they said. But we had, I had a lot of fun with him after games, a lot of night. We would be in a room, have dinner in a room. And what was really interesting, one night we were doing this in Detroit, and so it was my time to pay. And so he ordered 3 entrees, okay? but he was a character. He really was. I had a lot of fun
with him. That's what I want to know.
I had a lot of fun with him. A lot of fun.
Jerry, You retired at what age? 34?
Just getting ready to turn 35. Yeah, right.
Getting ready. So we looked it up, and you had an exhibition game where you scored 38 points, and the next day you retired. Jerry, what? What was that about?
Well, it's really weird, Pete. The year before, I had gotten in a, you know, you didn't have agents or anything, and I wanted to renegotiate my contract. And he, the owner said basically no. And then I said to him, I said, look, I said, I've done everything you ask of me. I said, I play when I'm hurt. I said, I play when doctors give me shots. I said, there's nothing I don't play with. I said, you asked me to lead the league, lead this team in scoring and assist, and you also want me to guard the best offensive player. And I said, I think that I should make more money. And it's the only really time that I had where I felt I had any leverage. And he basically said no. And so I'll never forget that day.
It was Jack Kent Cook.
Jack Kent Cook. I'll never forget that day. Larry Fleischer was trying to help me. And so they asked me, Larry asked me, would I be willing to go to Phoenix and play? I said, you know, I'd rather finish my career with the Lakers, but let me think about it. So I came to find out that they were maybe possibly thinking about trading Charlie Scott for me. And so I said, no, I'm going to go back and play. And the 28th game that season, we're playing a game in Houston. They had an old tartan court down there. And I tore a groin muscle. And I could not, Pete, I couldn't sleep for 3 months. I had to sleep with two pillows between my leg. I never had anything like that before. And it was an injury, I think, that like offensive linemen, defensive linemen, when you get hit and you're torqued and your body stops abruptly. And it was explained to me that, doctor, it's a football injury. So they sent me all over the country to try to find some solution to it. But there wasn't a lot of blood. It's a really small little area there. And so I missed basically the rest of the season until the playoffs. I never practiced once in that period of time. I was doing some light jogging, and I would do some shooting where, you know, just straightforward shooting. No running, hard running at all. So they basically said to me, we really want you to play. I said, well, the only way I'm going to be able to play is to, you know, to be shot up. And before the game, they gave me like six shots in my groin area, six, which helped the pain. And so we started playing the game and against the Milwaukee Bucks. And I made a last second shot to win the game, but I was absolutely couldn't do anything, but I did make a shot that won the game. And everyone was happy. You know, I'm back playing. We've had a day off, and the day off, I could hardly walk. It hurt so bad. And so they were going through practice the next day. I could not practice. I couldn't. I would shoot a little bit. That hurt. And so then the next game comes. They do the same thing. I could not play. No one wanted to experience that kind of pain. I couldn't play. And so after the season over, I heard from a lot of people that he said that I didn't want to play because he wouldn't pay me. And that really was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. But I did work out really hard that summer, Pete, and I ran a lot of hills. A late coach at UCLA by the name of Jim Bush, he was a famous track coach over there. He had me to start running hills, down the hill and particularly back up the hill. And so I would do that a lot. I lost a lot of weight and at that point in time. And I felt really good. I did feel really good. But I knew that this was not going to work. I knew I was going to get hurt. And Will Chamberlain was no longer there. Elgin Baylor was no longer there. And it was going to be me and a bunch of young guys. So we played that exhibition game against Portland and Bill Russell. Bill Walton. And after the game, Pete, I told the GM, whose name was Fred Childs, he was my college coach and also my professional coach when I first started. Mm-hmm. I told him, and Bill Sharman, the coach, I said, I need to talk to you guys. And it was really strange because I used to sit in a locker room. I can take my hand. Water would just drip off of it. So much adrenaline going through your body. And before the game, no water was dripping off my hand. It was only an exhibition game, but even exhibition games, I was like that. And after the game, I said, I can't do this anymore. I mean, it was like somebody said, don't do this. And I believed a lot of players play past their time, and I wasn't going to do it. Mm-hmm. I had too much pride in how I played and how much I cared about winning and how much I cared about how I played, because people I knew would pay to come see me play. I knew that.
Right.
I didn't want to think it, but I knew it. And Pete, I would have been the first $1 million player in professional basketball.
That year?
Yep. And I said no. I said no.
So that leads to my next question, Jerry, is that so you did not have a good relationship with Jack Kent Cook at the end, that's for sure. Why then did you accept to be the coach for Jack Kent Cook?
Well, Pete, I took basically 3 years off, and Bill's teams were not having very much success. And they were wanted to hire the late Jerry Tarkanian. And they met with him twice, I know. And then the guy who represented him, they found him dead in the backseat of a car here in Los Angeles. I mean, a horrible, horrible story.
Well, he was skimming money from the – that's what happens.
Well, I didn't know that. But anyway, Jerry went back and coached at UNLV and didn't leave. And so they called me about it. And I was really bored. All I was doing was playing golf, and I was just too young to just sit and relax. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, find something you love and you'll never work a day in your life. I've never worked a day in my life. I've been blessed in a sense that there's something about the bouncing ball, the noise in a gym, being around other athletes that was appealing to me. And the first year that I was involved, I asked him, because I didn't know anything about coaching. The only thing I knew was forget offense. Offense was easy. I wouldn't know how to run a scheme, a system, or anything. But defensively, I had an idea what we needed to do if we're going to be an effective team. So basically the same thing that Bill had, I took him and I told Abdul-Jabbar, I said, you're going to be the complete focus of this team, complete focus. And we're going to run an offense designed for you, but we're going to make it easier for you defensively. I just believe you isolate people on one side of the court. Don't let them use the other side of the court. And it was easier to help that way. Guys won't get backdoored out of plays like that. And my first year, we won more games than any team in the league. And all that was done, and I'm not saying it was me, but my two assistant coaches, the late Sam Allback, who I loved, and the late Jack McCloskey, who I loved, they were just great guys, and they knew they were nursing an emotional child. That's what they were doing.
That's you?
Yes. And even then, and still today, I guess. But I am emotional, and I care about winning.
I like nursing, though.
Well, I care about winning a lot. And even today, and my involvement with Clipper, I really care about winning. And I care about how athletes are doing. I like them put in the best possible situation, and particularly if they're good guys. They got to be good guys, and they got to have passion to play the game. But it's probably one of the happiest times I've ever had in my life to know that I had two guys who understood this very emotional person who was not qualified to be a coach because of his emotions. And during my 3 years here in Los Angeles as a coach, we had, I think we went almost at a 60% pace, basically with the same team as Bill had, only because we changed from an off. Bill wanted an upscale game, and his team simply wasn't qualified to do that. And then Bill had also lost his voice, which made it even more difficult to communicate. But after my second year,
Jerry, let's stick to that first. Let's stick to the first year. That was 76-77.
Was it? Yeah, I think
you
so.
You lost to the Blazers that year.
Yes, who won the championship?
Okay, but you owned them during this regular season,
yes,
correct?
Yes.
And then
what happened?
Lucius Allen got hurt.
We lose Kermit Washington, who was our answer and more than an answer for Maurice Lucas. Maurice Lucas would bully all our other players. He wasn't going to do that with Kermit.
Right.
And he got hurt, and then also Lucius Allen got hurt. And we played all these kind of heartbreaking close games, and it just took its toll on me, to be honest with you. I couldn't accept some of the things I was seeing. But Pete, like a year later, as you're well aware, you know, the league was really having a lot of problems with the players. It was a drug era. Let's face it, it was, and the league was aware of it. And it just, at times we would go on the road and I would see the characters come to the hotel and hang around, and I couldn't take it. Okay. I could not take that.
Right.
I've never been a real dissipator. I don't smoke. I'm never marijuana, no drugs, not even much of a drinker, to be honest with you. And for some reason, I was going through a divorce. The way I treated some of our players, even to this day, I'm embarrassed. I mean, really embarrassed. And I've told the ones that were around. I've apologized to every one of them that I was not fit to be a coach. And I said I'm ashamed of what my behavior was like.
Really?
And honestly, it was a relief to do that for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's not who I am as a person. I try to treat everyone nice. But it was just all the stuff I was going through personally.
Right.
And also knowing I was not helping these players grow. I was not. Our drafts were horrible at that point in time. We weren't getting any help for Kareem. And I said to him one day, I said, you know, Kareem, I said, I've watched you play. If you would play harder, can you imagine me that telling Abdul-Jabbar that he should play harder? I said to myself after my third year, when I was not going to do this anymore, and Jerry Buss, who had bought the team, wanted me to coach more, and I could not do it. There's no way. It wouldn't have been fair to the players.
Right.
And Abdul-Jabbar made the game look so darn easy, Pete, that you did not realize what he was doing. You did not. And he played emotionless, but he was, you know, people talk about great players.
Right.
My goodness. Today, some of these centers are playing today. You know, everyone wants to play from basket.
Right.
I would love to see somebody try to guard him. There's no way.
Jerry, let me back up a second, though. I think I'm correcting you, but Kermit Washington that year, wasn't that the year that he got into the fight with Rudy Tomjanovich?
Rudy Tomjanovich.
Oh, he didn't get hurt. You guys, I mean, your owner basically distanced himself from Kermit and then cut him or traded him, got rid of him.
The Boston Celtics.
Yeah, never practiced with you again. So, again, you were without Kermit and Lucius Allen, and, you know, the Blazers.
Well, they were good. They were good,
but they kind of lucked into that because I think you were undefeated against them during the regular season.
Well, again, Pete, I don't say anyone lucks into something, but circumstances certainly help.
I'll say it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But I think probably the crowning blow was when Kermit got into the fight with Rudy. And what people said about him was just awful. And I wanted an aggressive team, and we had an aggressive team. But never thinking the person who really started that wasn't Kermit, was not
Kevin Kooner.
Absolutely, you're absolutely correct. Right. No one ever said anything about that.
Right.
But that was the final straw for me as a coach. Everyone was so critical of him, calling him a thug. He was a nice person, a really nice person. And
Jerry, I know that for a fact because his PR guy, Mark Splaver, when he was in college, used to tell me about Kermit. And in my career, I'm only really disappointed with myself for two columns I ever wrote. And one was after that fight where, you know, Rudy came running at him and he didn't know. And he threw the punch. And I was totally out of line with that column I wrote. Kind of what you're saying, you know, I was one of those guys. And the other one was on a Marvin Webster column that I went after his wife in the column. not a good idea.
Well, you really know how to be a peacemaker, don't you?
Yeah, he's a Nobel Prize waiting to happen, isn't he? Jerry, if I can interject for a quick second, what 3 years is coaching? How did you see the game differently on the sidelines than when you saw it when you ran the offense?
You know, you can't teach instincts, okay? Sometimes you have to put guys on X's. That doesn't work. You have to be adaptable. And you also have to have players that complement each other. We didn't have enough players to complement Abdul-Jabbar, period. We did not. And today I think Kareem, because I've talked to him about it a lot and we still are very friendly. We speak some, not every day, but we speak a few times during the course of a year. And I see a different man and I think he sees that I'm a different person. He's really bright. When you have someone like this, who's an intellectual in the locker room, I used to watch him. He'd be reading these books that other players they might be reading comic books when they're that age. He would read things that were so important. And we got into talking about reading books. And frankly, he expanded my reading habits a lot, which I'm thankful for to this day. But he was one of those amazing players that if you watched him play, it was effortless, absolutely effortless. And it made me feel good that my relationship with him, he probably is disgusted with me. My relationship with him changed for a positive because I was very honest with him and also the other players I was very honest with.
Well, maybe you could talk to him about doing this podcast. He turned me down. But moving.
Well, you better call Deborah.
I better not. But I've known Kareem since he was at St. Jude's in the eighth grade. He came to my high school to try out for a scholarship. And the coach turned him down because Kareem wanted to be driven to school every day. So he went to Powell Memorial instead of Archbishop.
Yeah, I met him when I was a player and when he was in high school. And we talked. When he was in high school.
Really? So, Frank, that wraps up part one of Hoop du Jour. I mean, could it be any better listening to Jerry West?
It could not, because as we talked about, and as Jerry has certainly reinforced, if there is a living history of the NBA, it's him. And if you enjoyed part one, you'll love part two.
Amen, Frank. Thank you for listening to Hoop du Jour with moi, Peter Vesey, and column castigator Frank Drucker. You can listen to all Hoop du Jour interviews by searching Legends Studios wherever you get your podcasts.